Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've all heard about nicotine patches being used to help smokers kick the habit. A new study is investigating whether nicotine also improves memory. Ohio State is a site for the study. Dr. Douglas Shari is director of the Center for Cognitive and Memory Disorders at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for the invite.
So it's the Memory Improvement Through Nicotine Dosing Study, or MIND study. It's investigating whether nicotine can safely improve memory and functioning for those diagnosed with mild memory loss. How was the potential link between nicotine use and improved memory discovered?
Yeah, that's a great question, but nicotine goes back many, many years, and it is critical in the memory circuits. So there's a chemical in the brain called acetylcholine, which is very important for proper memory and good thinking. And it has many, many nicotine receptors that can stimulate acetylcholine, stimulate the memory circuit. So in people that have mild cognitive impairment, that are beginning to be a little bit more forgetful, NIH, National Institutes of Health, study is looking to see if we can have a symptomatic, something that will help with the memory and perhaps reduce progression to Alzheimer's disease by using nicotine as a chemical to do that.
So I remember back 100 years ago in my first job when I quit smoking and I went to turn in an article to an editor who said it was unintelligible. And I told him I quit smoking and he said, oh, okay, it's okay. But the point is, I always thought that maybe lighting up before I wrote a story was sort of a habit. Could it have also made me sharper?
Yeah, unfortunately for smoking, of course, it's the tar and all the toxins in the smoke that is the dangerous part. The nicotine is not. And so just wanted to make sure we got that in.
Of course.
Not a negative to take nicotine and all the horrible things with smoking. Please do not smoke.
Yep.
Are due to the toxins in the smoke itself, et cetera. But yes, I think there is a lot of good evidence that it helps. These circuits help with attention.
Yeah.
So focus, attention, and memory are the things that we're looking for, which are all sort of very key things for our day-to-day functioning.
You're talking here about using a nicotine patch applied to the body, just to underscore what you just said, not suggesting that people take up smoking to help memory. So nicotine patches, and it's strictly nicotine, I guess, that you're getting from those. What do we know about? So the brain and nicotine, how long has that been studied?
Oh, we've been looking at that for well over 30 years. Some of the early trials were looking at ways to improve acetylcholine. This is a chemical that's critical in memory. And there are many, many nicotine receptors. Some of the current medications approved for Alzheimer's have nicotine receptor enhancement effects. And so because nicotine, of course, is not something that will make pharmaceutical companies very rich, it's been around forever. To do these studies and to find things that are very safe and are helpful, we have the National Institute of Aging and the National Institutes of Health that have gotten together and sponsored this study. And this is sort of the largest study ever looking at nicotine and how it can infect and hopefully slow down progression of the memory loss.
Tell us how big the study is. It's also the longest running study of nicotine's properties in this regard. So tell us about how it's being conducted, how it works.
So there's many sites across the U.S. that are performing this site. Ohio State is one such site. And as with typical for clinical trials, you can either get the patch or you can get a placebo. So we need to determine, as in all clinical trials, and we're very grateful and appreciative of the time and energy that people take to do clinical trials. And then we measure a cognitive function before and after, and we're measuring for safety, of course, to make sure that the drug is efficacious and safe.
I think I learned about this from looking at some daily OSU newsletter or something they wrote in there, and that one of the issues was you are looking for participants, right?
Correct. Its study is ongoing right now. And what I might add is, in particular, all participants, they have to be 55 and older, just very, very mild cognitive symptoms. They can't have, moderate dementia or anything like this. It's just the very beginning symptoms. You're a little bit more forgetful. You write out a check or you pay a bill and then you pay it twice or something. Well, okay, that's not normal. Those are the types of things that you're beginning to have issues with memory or attention or focus. Those are the type of people we're looking for. But I wanted to mention specifically, we are very interested in getting Blacks, Hispanics, other underrepresented individuals. They are so few of these people that enter clinical trials, and we know so little about them. We need individuals in these groups so that we can get better treatments for them. Everyone's different. We have different genetics, we have different backgrounds. And so one medication may work for a certain group or ethnic group, may not work for the other. So, particularly, I very much stress anyone that, particularly ethnic minorities, to please consider getting involved in the trial. You may help yourself and will also help information and research about other people in your same ethnicity.
So is this something that you would first talk about with your doctor and ask them, do you think I'm one of those people? Or your spouse or your children might say, yeah, you're gay. How would you know if you're a good candidate for this when we're talking about mild cognitive issues?
A great question. So basically, if you're noticing a change in your thinking or memory or attention, you're making a little bit more mistakes, less efficient. You keep going to the store and you're forgetting your list. You're having a little bit more trouble. You used to be able to figure out how to do that TV remote or how to do that text. And now, gosh, how do I do that? It's not just like a forgetting a password or something. Or someone that knows you well, a family member, a spouse that says, there's been a change. It's just not you. You're doing worse. Or of course, your doctor can do it. But any of those things, you don't have to go through your doctor. You can come right directly to the memory center at OSU for the research center. We can tell you if you would qualify or not. Certainly, we accept referrals from physicians and primary care docs. But the important thing to know is all these medications that we have in these new studies help better, as you might imagine, the earlier you get in and be identified and start treating. Don't wait. Don't wait till it's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years you've been having problems. You have less options at that point. You want to get treated and identified early and get on some treatments or new studies.
I mean, if I'm out there listening, maybe, and I'm worried about mild cognitive or even moderate, I'm got concerns. I mean, anybody can get the patch, right?
You can get the patch. We don't know whether it's used or not. It's not FDA sanctioned. It's not approved for this condition.
Okay.
The dose is different than you would get in the study. And of course, it's important if you're interested in that to get into a study because that's how we find out about these things and find out whether it's helpful for other people or not.
And the dose is different. How different? How so?
It's a high dose of nicotine in the patch, comparative to the patch. I don't know the exact number or difference like that. But the most important thing is it has to be studied regularly to see compared to before and after whether it's helpful or not. Definitely, we don't want people to go to cigarette smoking. And of course, for nicotine patches, pretty much you have to have a doctor's prescription for those anyway. And since this is not an FDA approved indication, that may be problematic for that as well.
Nicotine, and I don't know the answer to this question. Nicotine does not occur naturally with tobacco, does it?
I believe it does. I'm not
Okay.
sure.
Okay. Because
I
I heard
believe.
about cigarette companies adding more nicotine. Nicotine is addictive, right?
Nicotine is the addictive substance in there, but there's no chance of nicotine addiction with this patch. It's been studied for more than 30 years. There's probably other features of addiction besides the nicotine, and it's mostly related to the side effects. So if you need more nicotine and it's helpful for your brain, okay, well, that might be something good.
And are there other side effects to nicotine?
there's not really that many side effects. Occasionally, people will get nausea, dizziness, headaches if you take the patch. Obviously, if you can't tolerate it, we won't continue you in the study. But most people tolerate the patch really well. And compared to a lot of other studies that we're doing, the side effects are really minimal.
And how long do you study people using the nicotine patches? How long do they wear them, whether it's the placebo or the nicotine?
Well, it's a daily patch, and the study's for 6 months. So during that time, you may be on a placebo or the nicotine patch, and we assess how you do with it.
What are you hoping from this? Because you mentioned that there's not a lot of money in nicotine these days. It's everywhere. Someone isn't going to discover it as a new cure. It's being using something old for something new. How do you get financing for this? Because I guess the tobacco companies aren't involved, right?
No, so this is through the National Institutes of Health. And so this is sponsored and paid by the government. And they will do these types of studies where there's significant potential impact. We know nicotine is involved in the memory circuits. We know memory is a very important early symptom of Alzheimer's. And so these types of studies are almost always performed by National Institutes of Health because other for-profit companies don't see the profit in it, and so they won't ever do the studies.
So once the studies are completed, though, and let's say hypothetically you find that it is effective in this regard, then who produces it? Then how does it get marketed?
Well, there's the manufacturers of the nicotine patch right now that can, increase their production. There'll be companies that will, obviously join in because they can make a profit because they can sell it. So at that point, they're all happy. They
Okay,
haven't done
they
all
don't
the
want to invest in the
research and
studies.
development. They haven't paid the
Gotcha.
$10 million to do the studies,
Gotcha.
but they'll gladly take the information and the profits for something that is worthwhile and useful.
What are your thoughts about whether or not nicotine treatment could help in moderate to more advanced cases of dementia?
I think there's less likelihood of that because there's so many things like for Alzheimer's disease, you have amyloid building up. This is a toxic protein, tau building up, neuroinflammation.
In the
There's so
brain,
many of
yeah.
in the brain, so many other downstream effects that have been occurring for years that other things that are destroying or ravaging the brain that helping just the it may help a little bit, but it would be around the corner, a little bit around the edges, I mean, and the impact would be much less. It's going to be most important early on. And of course, that's probably the most important time to preserve your memory is when you're still able to work and function and, have good thinking and be able to do day-to-day activities well.
So if you're by using this early on, if it works, and you aren't able to preserve your memory, does that put off dementia? Does it put off Alzheimer's?
So for Alzheimer's, we think there's lots of other factors, as I mentioned, these toxic proteins that build up. It's going to be one piece in our arsenal,
Gotcha.
right? So we had just the FDA just approved the aducanumab. This is sort of more of a controversial drug that's an anti-amyloid, gets rid of amyloid. So what we're thinking in the future is we have these medications that symptomatically help the memory work better. You're going to need some of those. Plus, you want to get some that get rid of those toxic proteins. Plus, you're going to have some that maybe reduce inflammation. So, just like diabetes or high blood pressure, people could be on three or four. And I think in the future, that's how we're going to treat this condition. So, this is going to be one very important piece early on to help individuals. And of course, since we don't have all those pieces right now, shoot, you might as well take something if we find that this is actually helpful and it's the positive study, then this would be something that people can take really early on to help, slow down the course. And then if you take this, who knows, there's another medication that might come up, just be discovered the year after that, and you can sort of keep going on for a while. So we're hoping to add all of these things and all our knowledge and science together to help people with cognitive disorders.
Dr. Shari, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's Dr. Douglas Shaari. He is director of the Center for Cognitive and Memory Disorders at Ohio State University. He specializes in cognitive disorders and dementia, including Alzheimer's disease. And we've been talking to him because Ohio State is a site for the MIND study. That's the Memory Improvement Through Nicotine Dosing Study. It's an NIH study, as he mentioned, and they're especially interested in ethnic minority groups participating in this. So if you're interested, we'll have a link on our website at wosu.org/allsides so you can learn more about it. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The pandemic, acts of violence, and natural disasters take a heavy emotional toll on the public. Mass shootings, more than 300 lives lost that way in the past year alone. Massive forest fires, epic floods, drought, and the deaths of more than a million Americans from COVID have stressed us out. Collective grief is a concept many of us have become all too familiar with. Gabes Torres is a psychotherapist and writer who has written on the topic of collective grief. We'll post an article by Gabes Torres from Yes Magazine at wosu.org/allsides. Gabes Torres, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
Give us a thumbnail of what you mean by collective grief and how it differs from individual grief.
I think the main difference is that collective grief has like a shared experience compared to how it is as an individual. Like I would think about natural or human-made disasters, that which I experienced growing up. I would think about even, like as a Filipino, I'm reminded of historical experiences of colonialism. There's a shared element to it that makes it different from an individual experience.
Does that make it easier or more difficult to address?
I think trauma and grief will always be difficult to address one way or another. I don't want to like compare individual from collective grief. Okay. There are parts of it that are easier. There are parts of it that are more difficult. I think that the easier parts of it is that there's a like a sense of validation, knowing that another person has experienced pain from this event, from this collective injury, that you don't have to question. You don't have to question about whether or not this experience really did hurt. And I think that the difficult parts about collective grief is that we have to go about that collectively as well, because it took place within the context of a community. And in the hyper-individualized West, that can be really, really difficult because it can be really, really vulnerable. And we don't have a lot of tools on how to go about processing grief, processing trauma as a community.
I mean, I think of all these knee-jerk reactions where there's candlelight ceremonies, where people lay flowers at a certain site or teddy bears or whatnot. You know, you always get the after a shooting, they have, you know, school counselors are available, you know, the next day, that kind of a thing. But it always does feel sort of thin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're mentioning like the symbols of how we can collectively grieve or heal together. And these are very important, like the vigils, like even on social media, there's an experience of solidarity whenever we see or post or reshare content that really name the atrocities that are happening. And yet, yes, there's a part of it that feels limited. Like what comes to mind as both a therapist and also an organizer, I think about how we need more than just symbols and representations. We also need, in certain contexts, we need action. And for some of us, we do need like practices of solidarity. Like there are some of us who will call legislators to help move forward with gun reform or gun control. And that to them is more meaningful than just going to a vigil, not to like compare or consider vigils to be less important, but there are some of us who do need a little bit more action-based ways of processing the grief.
And I wonder to what extent people understand that they're grieving, especially when they're very distanced from whatever the calamity is, whether it's a mass shooting or flooding or, you know, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm reminded of vicarious trauma or secondary traumatic stress, where there's been research around one, we have this thing called mirror neurons, where we are neurologically wired for empathy. Majority of us are, where, for example, if I see somebody, this is a little bit of a silly example, but I see somebody trip, the parts of my brain that know what it's like to trip are firing. So I have the capacity to feel that, to absorb the experience or the pain or the suffering of another. So we don't have to directly be a part of the event of the trauma to be able to absorb the experiences of another. In fact, the rise of social media increases our capacity for empathy, but also increases the likelihood for us to be burdened by the experiences of others, especially with the ongoing nature of crises these days.
And so the exposure is increased because of social media, and I don't know if that's a bad thing or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, just like any other, first I want to recognize that social media is a relatively new platform. So I feel like we are still, our
systems are absolutely. Still, I mean, it's only been around really to the way it is now, maybe less than a decade.
For sure. So I feel like our bodies are still catching up to the ongoing, even like flooding information that we are not psychobiologically prepared for. Like there are like, just like as any medium, like there are limitations, there are parts of it that can be useful. Like we need it to increase or spread awareness about social issues. And if not managed delicately, or if we're not as introspective about our consumption, can lead to different kinds of stressors. Like I think about the tendency to be desensitized to material that's really violent, and that does require some, we're not required, but it should invoke some feelings because another person is harmed. But then because of the ongoing consumption and the relentless news about crises, I don't want us to be numb to such news.
You know, I can remember where I was, the room, everything about the moment when I heard about the Columbine mass shooting at the high school. I can tell you other examples along since then of crises and tragedy, and I kind of can remember where I was, like with 9/11 or something like that. But I can't necessarily say the same about a lot of recent mass shootings now. Isn't as clear. They start to get jumbled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. In 2022 alone, we have at least 480 mass shootings in 2022 alone, and also in the US alone. So I cannot imagine what it's like. And I think specifically about those who are in the front lines of having to intervene. And I think about also therapists, like fellow therapists or clinical or social workers, who are not only witnessing a lot of these atrocities, but are having to hold other people's stories and trauma stories. So I feel like this article was meant to awaken us. Hey, where is our capacity? Where is our nervous system at when it comes to this level of consumption?
Communities of color experience collective grief in different ways from majority white communities. Can you talk about that and why that's relevant?
Mm-hmm. So I can only speak for myself. Okay. As a Filipino, a woman of color who, so currently I'm in the global South, but I did spend a significant time in the US for education and also for work. And So collective grief, I feel like in some ways we are more aware of this need to process our grief. And this is also not to assume that every person of color is aware of that or is going through the same process. But at least for me, there was an inherent awareness. There's like an intuitive inner knowing that I need to process this. And it feels like sometimes the sciences are just catching up with it. Not that we always need the sciences. Sometimes intuition it would suffice, or ancestral knowledge would suffice. But like I would think about the recent studies on the intergenerational transmission of trauma, that we've inherited trauma on not just a behavioral level, but a genetic, like a cellular level as well. So I feel like there's a, like, even though that has been verified now in the sciences, like I already knew that I inherited something, and that maybe in that awareness, I've also inherited my ancestors' grief. And right now, like as a woman of color who was in different ways targeted, harmed in the United States, and again, like this is different for a lot of other communities. Like I've had it, like I've experienced different kinds of violence, but I can't imagine what it's like for Indigenous and Black communities too. But like there's a, I feels a little personal, but I feel like there's already language for me. Sometimes it's not in English, and I feel really fortunate, but also I can feel blessed with having that language, but I can also feel angry about the reasons why I have to grieve in the first place.
You liken the process of dealing with this kind of grief to our metabolism, you know, and you've mentioned cellular level manifestations of it. So, what are some ways? I mean, is there a way to boost our collective metabolism?
Or yeah, I think about our collective capacity. So in the article, I briefly wrote about the process of oscillation. And here I bring up this mantra that my clients, my mentees, and I use, which is rest, digest, resist. And I think there's another step there, but it doesn't have to be like a linear sequence. The invitation is there will be times when we do need to resist, but to resist all the time, or to organize or mobilize or do solidarity work all the time, is not going to be sustainable. So we do need to rest, or we do need to digest, or in other times, we do need to play, because that's just our human, that's a recognition of our human capacities.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you really got me thinking about a couple of activists. I know that one died young and one took their life. And I wonder about the toxicity, the stress, the stressors, and what that meant, because they were never off, always on, always fighting the good fight. And you wonder about their health.
Right. That's part of the reason why I'm a therapist, is to provide clinical care and services to not just patients who are also activists and organizers, but also providing trauma-informed education to friends who are in organizing spaces, especially since 2020, that there's been a rise, an increase of organizing spaces, of activism. And on top of being in the pandemic and being isolated physically from other people, we need to pay attention to that we've lost touch with touch. And touch is really, really vital in our healing process and in our daily functioning.
As far as grief goes, some people say, well, you weren't even there. How can you be grieving? You can get judged for it, by others. What do you make of that dynamic?
Well, I would bring up again the neurological implications of that we do have. It's called emotional mirroring, and I also think that people have different relationships with grief. I know that for some, they're a little bit more distanced from having to feel. I'm not one who would kind of like judge or critique the ways that people grieve. Some people are a lot closer to their emotions, and that has a lot to do with their story. Others might need more time to actually take in the atrocity or the pain that, even though they weren't directly a part of, are devastated by. I just think that I would question their relationship with grief. And I know for myself too, like sometimes there's a part of me that does judge myself. Like, Gabes, you weren't, I would say the same thing. Like, Gabes, you weren't even there. Why are you this affected? You know, but then I would think about the overlapping experiences. Like, for instance, whenever, like, there's been a significant increase of anti-Asian violence in the United States since the pandemic. And there are times where I would judge myself for feeling so much after hearing about a murder of a community member in the Asian community. Mm-hmm. But then I would think about the times when, oh, I kind of, it's not obviously in the same, like, but I remember the times when I was targeted by a white person, by white communities for just how I look. So I would address, like, what are the overlapping themes, although not the same, that is going on here? And I think that that is an invitation to not shame ourselves, but to get to know ourselves and our own grief stories, that we connect, we're meaning-making creatures, that we make connections with the experience.
You know, I was listening to a report on NPR this morning about the wars, multiple, plural, in Afghanistan and how long they've been going on. And it did make me think about, you know, how they endure decade after decade after decade of war, invasion, war, you know, dictatorships, and whatnot. And I don't know. I mean, is the human psyche capable of really help in a healthy way managing that kind of collective grief and stress?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's unimaginable.
Yeah.
And I will never know what that is like. And this is when I would address that. I hope that as a human species, as much as we talk about or address the reports about these wars and these tragedies, that we would also address the ways in which we can intervene with where we're at. I think that, like, for instance, whenever there's a report about a shooting, like, I would tell people, I hope that we would talk about strategy as much as we also address the report. And this is not to diminish the grief and the pain from having to confront the report, but this is to also say that, you know, if we think that this is too much, it probably is. And it is likely that we have some degree of power. I'd like for us to not fall into despair with these things. And despair leads us to inaction. And perhaps, like, a way that we can increase our metabolism, our capacity for grief, is to find creatively and sustainably find the ways in which we can intervene with where we're at, and to do so collectively.
Gabes Torres, thanks so much for your time. I'm sorry, Gabes Torres. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Gabes Torres is a psychotherapist and writer who has written on the topic of collective grief. We'll post an article by Gabes Torres from Yes Magazine at WOSU.org/allsides, so you can learn more about this. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so I hope you'll stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The number of men getting vasectomies has been on the decline for nearly two decades, but that trend appears to have reversed since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June. Dr. Ranjith Ramaswamy is the director of the Reproductive Urology Fellowship at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Dr. Ramaswamy, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you very much, Ann.
What is a vasectomy?
So vasectomy is a permanent form of contraception in men. It's a procedure done in the office, which takes about 15 to 20 minutes under local anesthesia, wherein the two tubes that basically carry the sperm from the testis to the outside world are divided and clipped.
And how effective is a vasectomy in preventing pregnancy?
It's actually the best contraceptive method we have, both men and women included. It's about 99.99% successful. About 1% of men or less require vasectomies to be redone because sperm is still present in the ejaculate. But it's really the best form of contraception we have.
And before the overturning of Roe, vasectomy rates were on the decline over the last two decades. What do you think was going on there?
I think people were concerned about vasectomy's side effects. They were concerned that it could potentially cause problems with the testis, potentially problems with sexual dysfunction, libido, their ejaculate volume. And I think there are a lot of myths that sort of spread about the vasectomy and its potential problems, which is probably why it was on the decline. And people also didn't like the fact that it was a permanent form of contraception that, you know, that yes, reversal is available, but it's not often successful. And so all of those concerns probably led to the decline of the last two decades.
And also they didn't have to because there was birth control and abortion.
Absolutely.
How much has the demand for vasectomies increased since the Supreme Court decision?
I'd probably say it has doubled. We are seeing way more patients who want to talk about a vasectomy. They want to come into the office and discuss the option of vasectomy. And people seeking out vasectomies have also definitely doubled ever since the Supreme Court decision has happened. The one thing that has obviously changed in the demographic of patients that we are seeing are we're seeing a lot of young single men who are not in a relationship, who are not married, who have not had kids, now trying to seek a vasectomy. They're obviously thinking about freezing their sperm before they undergo the vasectomy, but the demographic has definitely changed since the Supreme Court decision, not just the volume.
So is that another thing that they're talking about, freezing sperm? It's not that they don't want to have children. They just want to guarantee that they don't have them until they decide they want them.
That's exactly right.
The future of contraception is an area of concern for some Americans since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, given suggestions by some that birth control could be next. Thoughts on the possibility of possible jeopardy of birth control and what that kind of impact that could have?
I think that would probably be a huge overreach if that happens with you know, moving from abortion to contraception. I think that is a big leap. I think there will be enough public outcry about taking contraception away from people, because now we're talking about potential teen pregnancies, you know, that can all happen if contraception gets banned or outlawed. I think that is a very big leap before we get there.
I wanted to talk about some of the fears people have. You said in relation to the two-decade decline, before the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the side effects, dysfunction, you know, dysfunctions and that,
yeah,
and that kind of thing affecting the penis itself. Some people are just worried about damaging that. Can you talk about what those fears are and dispel
Absolutely.
Them or underscore them?
Absolutely. So just because the vasectomy, the site of the testes is close to the penis, people think that there could be side effects because they're just close to each other. Thankfully, both the organs, despite being close to each other, i.e. the penis and the testis, are actually completely separate from each other. The blood supply, the nerve supply, everything is very different from each other. And so a vasectomy can absolutely not cause anything to any side effect to the actual penis, the erectile dysfunction, ejaculation, or the feeling or the sensation. In fact, there are studies that have shown the sexual frequency goes up after vasectomy, because now men don't have to think about the ovulation period and worry about getting their partners pregnant, that in fact it increases sexual frequency. So really no impact on sexual dysfunction, libido, the ejaculate volume remains the same because the contribution from the testis to the actual ejaculate volume is actually fairly small. And so men and their partners will often almost never notice a change post-vasectomy.
The procedure, as you mentioned, is reversible. You said, though, that it's not necessarily very, very successful. Can you talk about reversal and how that works?
Absolutely. So cutting anything in life is very easy. Putting it back together, a lot more challenging. There are not too many specialists that are even trained to put the vas back together with a vasectomy reversal in the United States. And it is often not covered by insurance, so it's likely an out-of-pocket cash pay procedure.
The reversal is not covered.
Reversal is, yes. The vasectomy is covered by insurance for now, but reversal is not. And there are lots of factors that go into a successful vasectomy reversal, both with surgeon expertise, the microsurgical skills that are being used, because you know you need to use a microscope, and it's about a 3 to 4 hour operation to do the vas back together. So not always straightforward, certainly possible. I do a lot of vas reversals, but it's not often successful if it's not done in the right hands.
You said vasectomies are covered by insurance for now. Are you concerned?
I mean, you brought up the question of what if contraception gets banned. I mean, obviously, then if it is a law, then insurance companies will have to sort of follow the law. But for now, it is not the law, and the insurance companies do cover contraception.
As far as freezing eggs, freezing sperm goes, is that typical in a consultation for a vasectomy? Is that a part of that conversation typically now?
Absolutely. So in men who have not had kids previously, I usually discuss freezing sperm with them. If they've had kids, we don't bring that up routinely. But if they've never had kids and they desire a vasectomy, I usually discuss a sperm freezing with them. Good news is sperm freezing has been around for about 35, 40 years. And even the longest studies have done that sperm is viable and functional even when it's used 15 years after sperm freezing. And so it is a reliable procedure and it can be done. And I do discuss it in patients who have not had kids and are still thinking about having kids in the future.
But it's not covered by insurance, I would imagine.
For now, it is not. Some states do cover it only in the context of patients who have cancer and are undergoing chemotherapy or radiation and are potentially about to lose their fertility. They can get coverage. But if it's pre-vasectomy, for now, it's not covered by insurance.
There are 11 long-acting reversible contraceptives for women. Men have only two. That's from the AMA, American Medical Association Journal of Ethics. What is your sense about why birth control methods focus on females so much?
I don't think it's a question of focusing on females. One, men obviously have vasectomy, which is a far more reliable contraceptive method and way more easy to be performed in the office setting as opposed to tubal ligation that has to be done in the operating room under anesthesia with potential.
Kind of the female equivalent is tubal ligation.
Yeah. Tubal ligation, which is a lot more challenging. So I think because men had the office procedure, surgical alternative to contraception and a one-time thing, I think investment in male hormonal contraceptives didn't happen as much. Having said that, there is a huge effort from the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, to actually invest in both hormonal and non-hormonal options. Research in male hormonal contraception or non-hormonal options are just a lot more challenging because of the potential side effects that can happen from these medications. In females, because there's a menstrual cycles, we're able to regulate them a lot easier and block the hormonal levels at the pituitary gland without affecting too many of the side effects. In men, there can be potential lots of side effects with both hormonal and non-hormonal options, which is why I think we don't have as many as we do in the female side.
What kind of side effects?
Potentially blocking testosterone production. The testis makes both sperm and it makes testosterone, and potentially blocking some of those proteins that make sperm can also block testosterone. And now you're thinking about giving the guy testosterone for the rest of his life. And so that's probably the biggest issue.
Interest in sterilization among women is also on the rise. Does the interest in sterilization from males match that from females? Do you know?
I do not know the answer. I think we're sort of very fresh from this Roe v. Wade. We've been a few months out of it. We don't actually have numbers. I do not do female contraception and see females in the practice, so I cannot attest to that. But I'm fairly certain, if you want me to take a guess, I think all couples, all partners, I think they're all interested in any contraceptive methods that they can get their hands on.
Yeah, I mean, are you surprised by this, the spike that's occurred? I mean, I understand that there's waiting lists now.
Absolutely. I don't think I'm surprised.
Okay.
Because right after the leak happened,
okay,
we already started seeing a spike. And so when the actual decision was announced, it was sort of natural for us to see the spike continue on that path. So not surprised, but I'd love to see what happens in 6 months to 1 year once the frenzy gets settled.
Yeah. And when you're talking to your patients during this period, post-leak and post-Roe v. Wade, do they talk about that as the inspiration? Do they tell you that?
Absolutely. I mean, especially some of the patients who are single and have not thought about starting a family yet and come to us specifically about the decision, I usually encourage them to see a psychologist just to make sure that they understand the ramifications of truly what a vasectomy is and what that decision process that they're making, because it is a permanent form of contraception. Yes, VAS reversals are available, but patients need to understand that this is a permanent contraception. And I usually encourage them to speak with a psychologist to make sure that that decision-making process is rational and sound.
Is it hard to find a physician that's able to do vasectomies?
No, I think most urologists are able to do a vasectomy. In fact, it's probably one of the most common procedures that urologists do. I don't think that there is an issue in finding people to do a vasectomy. But if the demand keeps going up and up, I don't think we are going to have enough urologists to be able to cater to such a large segment of the population.
When I was preparing for this, it kind of cracked me up that there are certain times of the year that vasectomies are more popular than others. That's when there's like big sports events on television.
That's correct. Yeah, the March Madness is often associated with huge increase in numbers. But now this is just every month could be its own madness.
Every month is a March Madness.
Yes.
So big difference. And a vasectomy, you said it only takes a few minutes and that insurance covers it. So it's not expensive anyway.
No, absolutely not. So far, we've rarely seen insurance denials for a vasectomy.
What are you going to be looking for in the coming, you said, in the next 6 months? What kind of numbers, I mean, given the spike that you've seen already, what are you expecting? Maybe tempered over time or what?
I'm fairly certain we will get more clarity from the legal legislative side. We saw what happened in Kansas. Every state is going to enact their own legislation.
What happened in Kansas?
I mean, they voted to make sure that abortion was still, you know.
Oh, yes. Of course. Yes. It's still state right. Yeah.
It's still legal. It's a state right. So I think every state is going to be different from each other. I'd be curious to see what happens in states that still have their protection versus states that do not. And I'd like to see legislative action come out after the elections that happen in November and see what's on the ballot and what's not. I think this is a very interesting time for reproductive rights, and we'll see how it all plays out.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Ramasamy. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Anne.
That is Dr. Ranjith Ramasamy. He is director of the Reproductive Urology Fellowship at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks so much for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.